We're talking with J. Michael Harrison in Philadelphia, and I'm really excited to be here talking to you about jazz music.
Well, you know, it's I think between the both of us, we could probably go on for a lifetime or two chatting about everything that revolves around both radio, of course, and the wonderful music that I think we are passionate about, that's ingrained in our DNA. We couldn't live without it. So it's always a pleasure to chat about something that, you know, I truly love and probably couldn't exist without.
Well, given that we could probably talk for a couple of days, let me make the first question just unbelievably broad. What is it about Philadelphia jazz that is maybe different from another city's jazz or a scene that's different than, say, Chicago or New York even?
Well, you know, this is the city of brotherly love and the city of neighborhoods. And, you know, I think there is that aspect of it. You know, I've had a chance to spend time in New Orleans and not a whole lot of time in Chicago, but a lot of time in New York City as well. And, you know, I think, you know, I've seen a certain level of camaraderie in New Orleans, and I think that exists here as well. And but I think probably, you know, that neighborhood, that community, you know, you look at some of the musicians that come out of the Germantown section of Philadelphia, and some of the musicians that come out of North Philadelphia and South Philadelphia and so forth. You know, there's a consistency. I think there's a dedication, a strong dedication to the art form, to the profession, to making sure that your chops are on point. And, you know, again, I think the legacy that Philadelphia offers is special. You know, I think it can be separated from a lot of cities. And, you know, when you look at someone like a John Coltrane, you know, who his time here was really a special time. And, you know, the folks that were able to connect with him during that time frame and the folks that were developing their own style, systems of music, if you will. I think Philadelphia has a lot of that, a lot to offer and a significant legacy that, you know, separates it from some of the other great jazz cities.
And, you, of course, you grew up here. And so not only did you probably hear jazz growing up, but, I mean, the history of Philadelphia music is so rich and incredible. What were some of your earliest memories of music here, especially live?
You know, I always tell folks that I think in a certain respect, I was born to pursue this path. It was predestination. It was something that I couldn't avoid because the very first record that I commandeered, procured, if you prefer, was James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And, you know, my Aunt Margie had the 45, and she ran it in the hole, and she saw the way it affected me. So she would not be able to keep it from me. So she told my mother, yes, he needs to take it home with him because I see what it's doing to him. So that was the very first recording that I ever connected with. But my older brother, John Harrison, he played guitar and still plays. And I have a cousin who's a drummer, Harry Butch Reed, who's, you know, very active on the Philadelphia scene and beyond. The two of them played in bands as teenagers. Also, I think a time in Philadelphia, you know, the nation, where you didn't have as many distractions, the internet and social networking and what have you. Folks were outside more, and the music, I remember, I grew up literally two blocks from Connie Mack Park, which was right next to Connie Mack Stadium. And as a kid, you know, I can recall being in the swimming pool of Connie Mack with my father on his shoulders. And there would be, you know, cats, mostly cats, not a lot of kittens back then, but mostly cats with saxophones and percussion instruments. And there was music. And so I remember that. And the funk bands, you know, every few houses, if not every few blocks, there was some band in the basement, you know, somebody on drums and a bass player just trying to cover what was happening musically, from the Motown sound to, you know, what's happening with Miles, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s and what have you. So the music was around me, from family members to the community. Growing up in North Philadelphia, walking distance to Temple University's campus, you know, I remember, you know, sneaking into parties on Temple's campus as a kid. So it was there all the time.
Now, when did you make the transition from a music guy to a radio guy? Was this something that was a natural course, or did you stumble into it?
Yeah, it was, you know, I've always been a huge fan of radio. Not that I dislike television, but, you know, music, you know, as Gary Bartz would say, is my sanctuary for sure. And I discovered radio as a young person, and all up and down the dial, AM and FM, and was just curious and open. And I think that was one of the things that I learned from my cousin and my brother. You know, it wasn't intentional, but just to see and hear that they were so wide open with, you know, whatever they were listening to. You know, they weren't limited to a specific genre. And I think radio was a little different. You know, back then it was a little bit more open as well, not so demographically driven. So I was really exposed to a lot of music. And as I started gravitating towards the radio myself, having that type of freedom to accept music for what it was, I embraced it. And I think I was kind of fortunate because, you know, some of the radio, the urban contemporary radio that you were hearing, you were hearing jazz on commercial radio. So, you know, again, it was wide open, but the college stations between the University of Pennsylvania, between Drexel and Temple University, that was, you know, an added attraction. So, you know, Temple at one point was a 24-hour jazz station and known as the Point of Jazz. And Drexel had phenomenal programming as well. Blue Genesis Jazz, an experimental radio project, and Diaspora, you know, these shows go back a little bit. And the live activity that was happening in the studios of these radio stations, and, you know, great musicians from Philadelphia and beyond were coming through and playing in stations. And Drexel had the Eight Phases of the Black Experience in Music, which was really, you know, it was special. It was giving you music. Each station was giving you music that you weren't hearing on the other, but it was phenomenal. And, you know, of course, there was some crossover, but they had their own identities. And I was just sucking it all up. I was wide open to it all. So for me, I stand on all those shoulders. You know, I'm influenced and inspired by all that came before me. And a lot of that changed. A lot of that went away. So I was kind of left in a position of trying to find what I desired musically. I would go to an Alan Holdsworth concert and see a lot of, you know, folks that, you know, were crazy about what he was doing, but we weren't hearing it on the radio. You know, I would see the Art Ensemble of Chicago, but you weren't hearing it as frequently as you'd like to hear it. So it was either you live with what you're given or you try to do something about it. So ultimately it was kind of frustration. And you know, I think during college, I used to send tapes to friends. I would make, you know, what I guess essentially today would be kind of a mixtape, and send them to friends and do quirky stuff like, stop at a certain point in the tape and then start on the other side. So they would have to flip the tape over and, you know, just to try to make it interesting. And, you know, I got a lot of good responses from the tapes that I was making. So I think there was a certain level of confidence, and probably one of the biggest things, you know, we talk about our teachers and the folks in your life that you come across. And, you know, I really believe if you kind of pay attention and listen to the rhythms of the universe, they're leading you on a journey if you follow them. And, you know, I had either eighth or ninth grade teacher, Mrs. Fales. What a name for a teacher, right? but it wasn't spelled like that. But Mrs. Fales, she taught history, and she tried to get me to recite poetry in front of the student body, which there was no way that was going to happen. Not during the gang war era in Philadelphia, and you know, in the 60s and 70s, no way I saw doing that. But I never forgot that this is a woman that, you know, said to me, "You have a really nice speaking voice, and you should try to do something with it." And as I said, she tried to get me to present a little Edgar Allan Poe, but I couldn't see that. But that's something that always stuck with me. And as my passion for music continued, every penny that you could come in contact with was going towards the purchase of, you know, an album or a cassette. Folks started looking at the collection and saying, maybe you should be in radio. And, you know, starting to do the math and say, well, Mrs. Fales says, you know, speaking voice, and you've got this ever-growing collection of music, and the music that you want to hear is not on the radio the way you want to hear it, kind of gave me the idea of giving it a shot. And that was really what led me to get involved with radio.
What do you do at that point when you decide, okay, all these things are converging, I want to be on radio? You just march into a radio station and say, let me on. It's all converging.
Essentially, that's it, though. you know, it's again, following the rhythms of the universe. A friend of mine's brother-in-law sat in on somebody's show one night on a very small radio station. And I felt that this individual was horrible on the radio. And again, you know, sometimes you know, it takes maybe hearing somebody else to realize that maybe I can do that and do it better. So I literally approached that radio station not too long after consulting a few friends and family members about giving it a shot, and they all felt, why not? I approached that radio station about doing a show in the afternoon, one day a week for a couple of hours. And that was the start. They gave me the green light to give it a shot. And the rest is history.
Do you have any air checks from those days or recordings? Or even the mixtapes still in existence? Or?
For the longest time, through the wonderful technology of cassette and 120-minute tapes, I used to record pretty much every show. So somewhere in my basement, talk about the basement tapes, somewhere in the basement, there's probably somewhere around 70-75% of all the shows that I've done, probably up until maybe about 2005, six, from about 93 to about 2005 or six, maybe a little later. I have a recording of a lot of those shows, and not just the air checks, the music and everything, the complete show.
Do you listen to them back? And
you know, I used to, because I thought, you know, just as air checks, you know, I thought it was an excellent way to try to hone my skills and you know, sharpen the skill sets. So I used to listen from that perspective. But also, again, I was playing the music that I loved. So I'm listening to hear the music as well. And some of the interviews, you know, just remarkable moments. I remember having Odine Pope, Byard Lancaster, and Prince Lachey after Odine performed for about a week up at the Blue Note. They stopped by the studio and played in the studio, you know, just bright moments, moments the very first time Jill Scott was on the microphone and she performed a poem that ended up, you know, years later being a song on her first release, her first CD. But it was kicked just as a poem back then. And, you know, so just tremendous moments where I was pinching myself in the studio, thanking God that I had the bright thought to record, you know, the show, because what was captured was priceless. So recording those shows provided a certain level of archival of just incredibly bright moments, you know, as well in the studio.
I'm sure you get hundreds and hundreds of recording CDs coming your way constantly. And I know a lot of them are probably local. What ones have come in where you just go, this reaffirms my faith in jazz? Or, you know, because I've gotten to the point where I figured at this point I would be tired of listening to new records and things, but I'm not. I'm just not. And because there's always something that just seems to come down the pike that makes you go, gosh, music is wonderful.
Yeah, well, you know, over the years, there's been, you know, just certain moments you come in contact with recordings or artists, and you know, and they stand out. You know, locally, there's you know, so much talent. We're so talent rich in this area. But I remember Anthony Titt. Anthony Titt is a bass player, and much more beyond that. He's from the UK originally, but has been in Philadelphia for quite a period of time. And I'm trying to think. I think I first came in contact with his music from a compilation CD out of the UK, out of a magazine. And it was his ensemble known as Quite Sane. And a friend of mine picked up the magazine and he had the compilation. And I don't remember whether he bought two because he knew I would have to have it, or I immediately purchased it after he got it. But it was a kind of an M-Bass collective. So Gary Thomas, Steve Coleman, Greg Osby, Cassandra Smitty, you know, they all have tracks. Trying to think, there's a saxophonist out of the UK, Steve Williamson. I think he had a track on there. And then there was this Quite Sane track on there. And I'm like, who is this? So that was kind of my first introduction. But later on, there was a group here in Philadelphia that featured three poets out front and, you know, rhythm section. And the group was called G.O.D. And I don't remember what it stood for. But Tid was actually playing keyboards in this band. And one of the leaders of the band had no idea that he played. He was Steve Coleman's bass player as well. He was just Tone Dog, the keyboard player in the band. So I remember playing that track for Sabella is the poet. MC, he's from the West Coast and has been back there for years. Phenomenal dancer as well, but he was one of the leaders of G.O.D. And I'm saying, man, you know, Tone Dog is a phenomenal musician. You guys have him playing keys in your band, but he's like a great musician. So as I got to know Tid from that group and Steve Coleman, I was curious about more of his music. So, you know, I stayed on him constantly about, you know, when is the Quite Sane project coming? Not just because he was shocked that I had that demo. All right. He was, how did you get that? You know, I'm like, well, it's a compilation CD. So ultimately, he starts recording Quite Sane here stateside. And actually, you know, I'm curious, he probably recorded in the UK, because some of the artists on there are pretty much staples on you know in the United Kingdom. So, any event, he starts recording that stuff, and he gives me a sample of maybe six of the tunes, and I pop it in a CD player in the car, and I'm driving, and jaw dropped, just totally blown away to the extent that as I get to my house, I have to just keep driving right past my house because I cannot stop listening to this. So that project is called The Child of Troubled Times. And actually, Sabella from G.O.D., his children are on the cover of that CD, Anthony Tidd's quite sane project. But that CD, really, it's you know, it covers a lot of ground. It's very reminiscent of what you might hear, you know, from that 80s period with Steve Coleman and Osby and that polyrhythmic, you know, structure and what have you. But there's also on some of the songs, poets and rappers, as well as singers, Eska Mtunwazi out of the UK, Marcia Arnold, they're on those. Matter of fact, Miguel Zanon, I think, is playing sax on several of the tracks on there, and Steve Coleman is as well. So that was one of those moments. Probably another similar moment for me was the first time I heard Jimmy Merritt playing Jimmy Merritt's music. Again, just a shocking experience because he's opening up. He comes out and he has an electric bass, you know, and this is Jimmy Merritt in his 80s. I don't expect an electric bass. So that just caught me off guard. But the configuration of his band and the system of music that they present, again, just really phenomenal, you know, jaw dropping experience hearing his music because, you know, I you hear it on Live at the Lighthouse. You hear it, you know, with Max Roach a little bit. You don't get, you know, to the full extent. So hearing his music, the forerunners presenting his music, that was really, again, jaw dropping.
If someone's coming to Philadelphia for the first time and they want to go find jazz, where do you send them?
To all the edges of Philadelphia, you know, there's South Jazz Parlor, you know, which is still relatively new, a couple of years in experience. But the folks behind that, the Bynum Brothers, have a long history in presenting jazz in Philadelphia. Chris's Jazz Cafe would be another location. The Painted Bride Arts Center is going through some changes, but their history is phenomenal. If they're still around in the form that they are today, you would want to look to see what's going on with them. Philadelphia Clef Club of Jazz and Performing Arts. Again, checking out what's happening there. But also entities like the Philadelphia Jazz Project produces a lot of activity with a lot of local artists. So checking out their website would be, you know, an integral part of your visit and your search. The Ars Nova Workshop as well, you know, especially leaning towards the progressive and avant-garde side of things. You would really want to look at that. But probably the central source, you know, that you want to check might be Jazz Near You. Jazz Near You, which is in so many cities in the United States, but around the world as well, as well as allaboutjazz.com, you know, both produced by Mike Ritchie, who lives in this area. So those websites give you a nice picture of what's happening on a daily basis in different cities. And, you know, it does a nice job of giving you some insight. This year at Temple University, we started the Write a Swing Cafe that takes place on select Thursdays throughout the semester. So if you're here during the college season, I mean, we just had Obed Calvert with the Curtis Brothers there, you know. Just some wonderful presentations. The Landon Brothers with a couple of musicians from Italy recently. So there's been some really, really nice, and they're free as well, these Writers' Wing Cafes here on Temple's campus. So, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunities, but Jazz Near You and some of the major presenters, there's a lot to check out.
Is there one interview you've always been after, you've never been able to get? Or is there someone on your list that, boy, you just want to talk to more than anybody?
That's really a good question. I was just looking back a little ways, you know, that I think there's well over 1,000 plus interviews that, you know, I've been able to do. And, you know, as I was saying earlier, it's just so many bright moments. So to isolate one person that I haven't gotten to as of yet, I can't really say. I mean, you know, there's, you know, obviously some folks that are in foreign countries that I haven't gotten to the way that I'd like to. I'm not the biggest fan of phone interviews. So there's folks that I'd really like to have in the studio with me. And, you know, I would say one of those folks that hasn't been in the studio with me is Stanley Clark, Philadelphia's own. We've done phone interviews, but he hasn't been in the studio with me. And I'm on him because there's a long time since he's actually been to WRTI. So he's long overdue, although he's threatening to come by. But that's somebody I'd love to spend about 3-4 hours, you know, in the studio, maybe sitting there with a bass and playing around with that. You know, I think that'd be really cool. You know, I think DeNardo Coleman, he was here in Philadelphia recently with a reunion for Prime Time, and just, you know, spending time with him talking about, you know, his father, you know, playing with, you know, his father as a kid, you know, those experiences I think would be phenomenal as well. Brotzman, that would be, you know, Casper and you know, Peter Brotzman, I think that would be a nice conversation as well. So there's been a whole lot of bright moments, but hopefully there's more to come.
Always. Well, this has been one for me, so thanks for talking.
I'm glad we could do it, and really great to have you hanging out in Philadelphia for a little bit.
Yeah. This is Todd Steed at the studios at WRTI with J. Michael Harrison.
That's a wrap.